great issues of our times are the return of fascism to the United States and Europe, climate change, and the stagnation of the world capitalist economy. These great issues are pressing and interconnected. We used to think that the experience of World War II guaranteed that no politician would ever advocate the ideas of fascism. But the election of Donald Trump a year ago has caused a serious reconsideration of fascism and its relationship to capitalism and to democracy. The neoliberals paved the way for Trump. Now he and the forces aligned with him have put our democratic institutions under attack in order to protect the rule of the wealthy. The attacks include the right to vote, labor unions, public education, an independent news media, independent public universities, the privatization of much of traditional governmental functions, and making it almost impossible to launch a new political party. The election of Trump is a political development that, for concrete sociological reasons, allows us to see it for what it is, as a type of neo-fascism. Only by identifying the phenomena correctly can we effectively fight it. Jack London wrote a century ago in his famous book, The Iron Heel, that, quote, "There is a shadow of something colossal and menacing that even now is beginning to fall across the land. Call it the shadow of an oligarchy, if you will. It is the nearest I dare approximate it. What its nature may be, I refuse to imagine. But what I want to say is this. You are in a perilous position." We speak today with John Bellamy Foster, the editor of the magazine Monthly Review, about his new book, Trump in the White House, Tragedy and Farce. Foster is a professor of sociology at the University of Oregon. He has written widely on political economy and has established a reputation as a major environmental sociologist.
John Bellamy Foster, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Glad to be here.
Donald Trump has brought together white supremacists, Christian fundamentalists, neo-fascists, and capitalist billionaires. You've subtitled your book, Tragedy and Farce. In this collection, can you tell us what do you mean by tragedy?
Well, the combination of white supremacists, Christian fundamentalists, neo-fascists, and capitalist billionaires is certainly a tragedy in the political sphere, but that's not what I meant by tragedy. What I meant was something more complex and fundamental, and that is the U.S. economy began slowing down its growth rate. What we call economic stagnation actually began in the mid-1970s. And has worsened up to today, particularly with the great financial crisis. And the response of the system was the generation of neoliberalism, which was a kind of austerity approach that has ultimately been unsuccessful, and the economy is stagnating even more. And what we're seeing is a hard turn to the right, a growth of neo-fascism, as a result of this larger structural crisis of the system. This is a tragedy because the society keeps on turning to the right, turning the screws on the population rather than addressing its fundamental problems.
From a broader sociological perspective, who brought Trump into the White House, and what is his social base?
Well, if you look just at the election, and you look at it from an economic standpoint, which is always useful, and from a class standpoint, you find that Trump won a plurality of votes in the 50,000 people with incomes of $50,000 to $200,000. Those are family incomes. The bottom 50% of the population cutoff is around $56,000. So you're basically, what in economic terms, Trump's support mainly came from the lower middle class, primarily, not from the extremely wealthy and certainly not from the working class, although segments of the working class, particularly more privileged elements, voted for him. And his vote, of course, came predominantly from the white population, which, you know, the lower middle class is predominantly white, and it came from religious, the more religious parts of the population, and more rural parts of the population, and the less educated. So you get a pretty clear picture. One thing that I find significant is of those who said that they had lost income in the previous 4 years, who had done financially worse in the 4 years previously under Obama, 77% of those voted for Trump. So there's a very strong economic aspect to all of this, a class aspect. And it isn't really the white working class, as is commonly said.
Making a parallel with fascism in Germany under Hitler, did Hitler enjoy the same kind of social base, lower middle class, that Trump gets here in the United States?
The base was very, very similar. The political base is very similar, and this was noted by Gallup shortly before the election. They based on their poll data, but Hitler's support came primarily from the lower middle class. It came from religious Protestants, not Catholics. It came from rural sectors. It came from those who wanted an expansion of the military. But it's very, very similar, particularly the lower middle class base. In U.S. politics, the politics has been geared, the Republican Party politics has essentially been defined by the capitalist class. The Republican politics, although they have appealed to people who are down and out and the bottom, and people who have racist and chauvinistic views, the politics has really been defined by the top and the leading economic interests. The Democrats have traditionally tried to create an alliance between the upper middle class and the working class, but the politics has been defined pretty much by the upper middle class. To have a political movement that's actually based on the lower middle class is historically understood as quite dangerous, because the lower middle class, especially in our period, they are suffering economically. They're downwardly mobile. They are often feel rage towards the working class, and particularly the lower elements of the working class that are always the racially oppressed. And they tend to ally themselves with the very top monopoly capital, the financial elite, financial capital, but they rage against aspects of the system. So they're a very dangerous and volatile political base for any political movements, the state, and this is where fascism, in its various forms, has traditionally come from.
John, the title of your book is Trump in the White House, Tragedy and Farce, and I wanted to ask you about the farcical aspects of his regime. I mean, after all, these people deny human-caused climate change.
Yeah, well, I think that there's so many farcical aspects that, with Trump's tweets that it's we could come up with a very long list. But I would put at the very top that the rejection of science, with respect to climate change. Actually, all aspects of science are being essentially denied, and this is something that I never really expected to see in the political system in the United States, very systematic rejection of climate change for clearly economic reasons is a kind of a farce. It's basically putting your head in the sand, ostrich-like. We see all sorts of aspects of this. And I think, though, we should not emphasize the farcical aspects too much. And then it's easy to see some people say, well, Trump is a clown. But I think it's much more serious than that. The way I define him in the very beginning of my book, and the book isn't so much about him as it is about the political changes that are associated with him. The way I define him in the beginning of the book is he made a statement where he could stand in the middle of the street in Manhattan and shoot somebody. He said this in a half-jokingly way, and he wouldn't lose any votes. And what that is a statement that he can act with impunity without facing any consequences. To have that kind of a president in the White House is a very frightening thing.
John, can you talk a bit about his advisors, especially some of the members in his cabinet?
Well, of course, in my book, the advisor that I focused on the most was Steve Bannon, who's now gone, but still has a very, very interesting and important relation to the Trump administration. But, you know, right now his advisors consist of, there's John Kelly, who really represents the hard right. He's been coming out of the military, but very, very hard right positions. Stephen Miller, who is a key advisor, speechwriter for Trump, he's really a very important figure in this, and he comes from Breitbart, of course. And there's Jeff Sessions, represents a kind of combination of white supremacism, Christian fundamentalism, and neo-fascism in himself. The administration is dominated now by generals. A columnist recently called this a benign junta, but it's very worrisome. The U.S. government has traditionally been under civilian leadership, and it doesn't bode well in terms of our foreign wars. Jim Mattis, who's the Secretary of Defense, his nickname is Mad Dog Mattis, and there's every reason for concern in terms of Trump's advisors. Although Bannon is out and is sort of playing a role, in a way, it's a very supportive role in terms of a hard turn to the right outside the administration. We still have people who raise the question of neo-fascism within the administration, and of course, Trump himself raises it constantly.
John, you write that fascism is one of the two major means of political management adopted by ruling classes in advanced capital states. Can you explain this, please?
Well, what we consider the traditional form of management of the state under capitalism has been what we call liberal democracy, what political theorists call the system of liberal democracy. Liberalism in its classical meaning is more like what we think of neoliberalism. Liberalism means sort of possessive individualism on the market, free market individualism, that sort of thing is traditionally, in the classical sense, liberalism was a market ideology, very much opposed to democracy, and which democracy was associated with the rule of the poor or the rule of the masses. But what evolved in the late 19th century and the 20th century was a system called liberal democracy, which was seen as kind of a centrist political system that kind of an amalgamation of liberal views in the market and democratic views and basically erected around the vote and so on. And this is a liberal democracy is usually controlled by the political elites traditionally, and it's a system that works very well with capitalism. But capitalism has been in a deepening crisis for some time. To understand how serious the problem is, Larry Summers recently came out with a chart showing that the trends in the economic growth, and by 2012, according to current trends, the growth rate of the economy since the Great Financial Crisis or the Great Recession will have been lower in that 12 years than the 12 years following the stock market crash in 1929, stock market crash in 1929. So in other words, the economy will be more stagnant over a 12-year period than what it was following the onset of the Great Depression. And this is having huge effects, and it's created a crisis for the system, and it's now affecting the political state. So the response to the slowdown of the economy was neoliberalism, which is a form of austerity politics. There's more to it than that. But it was developed by the elites and is very tied to financialization strategies. But this began to fall apart, and the lower middle class especially was suffering. And so we have a kind of a revolt from the right and the growth of neo-fascism. It really means the breakdown of the liberal democratic state in its neoliberal vision. And whenever capitalism becomes unstable, when accumulation isn't working, when the state is not able to operate, and it hasn't been able to function very well in recent years, as everybody knows, then as the system goes into crisis, it tends to turn to the right as its solution. And that means breaking down a lot of the human rights that exist, political rights, and concentrating power in the system.
John Bellamy Foster, you've recently had published the book Trump in the White House, Tragedy and Farce. And I read the entire book in the last couple of days. I have to say this is a really fine contribution, and I would urge everybody to get Trump in the White House. Say that Trump has secured a beachhead in the White House, but there are still loose ends, you write, that need to be tied up. And from their point of view, what loose ends are we talking about? What do they need to do?
Well, they came in like gangbusters. Remember, and Bannon was the brains behind it. I know Trump wouldn't like that, but they were talking in terms of the deconstruction of the administrative state. It was a period of what was called Gleichschaltung in Germany under the Nazis. It paralleled that. Basically, it's not the same. This is neo-fascism. It's not the fascism that existed in Germany, but it's part of the same genus. And the goal was to gain control by basically bringing into line the other components of the state, because the White House is only part of the state. in political theory terms. Trump had the Oval Office, but he didn't really control the Congress. Even with the Republicans dominant in Congress, most of the Republicans were products of the liberal democratic system. They weren't. They didn't have represent the same movement as Trump or the same ideology. But of course they had to. They went after the national security state and the media first. They also challenged the legal system, challenged judicial review, went after the education system. It was very, very systematic at first, and of course, changing the immigration laws. All of this is sort of racism, racial ideology was used to enlist support from Trump's base in these actions. But it was basically the attacks on the various sectors of the state. They went after the scientists and within the Environmental Protection Agency and the Department of Energy and so on, went after any kind of climate science. It was very serious. And they failed in some respects in this strategy because they went after the national security state, and the national security state sort of fought back, or what that's sometimes called the deep state, the intelligence community, because Trump challenged some of the norms with respect to U.S. imperialism, U.S. military, U.S. wars, and geopolitics. And, of course, you know all about Russiagate and everything else. And the initial strategy wasn't entirely successful. And the influence of this this revolt has been confined largely to the White House. They haven't been able to extend it beyond the executive as much as they wanted to. Bannon eventually was out. The strategy now, of course, is to change the Congress itself. And so you have Bannon supporting Ray Moore in Alabama, who looks like he's going to be the next senator from Alabama, even though he says that homosexual conduct should be illegal and is really a fascist by anybody's definition. Jeff Flake just said he's retiring in Arizona because he was going to lose in re-election. Bannon supporting Kelly Ward, who is another rabid anti-immigration build-the-wall neo-fascist. And so they're working on the strategy from that angle. They're trying to strengthen Trump's base within the whole political sphere. So these are the kinds of things that are happening at this point.
John, the New York Times had several stories last week on Flake and the speech that he gave on the floor of the Senate. And they talked about not just Flake criticizing what's going on, but McCain, ex-President Bush. Flake was quite alarmed by what's going on, and he said, "We have given in or given up on the core principles in favor of a more viscerally satisfied anger and resentment. To be clear, anger and resentment that people feel at the royal mess that we've created are justified, but anger and resentment are not a governing philosophy." And I think that Flake hit the nail on the head. Anger and resentment may not be a governing philosophy for him, but that's the governing philosophy of Trump and his people. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah. Flake was a conservative, obviously, and right-wing in his own way. You can't call Flake a liberal, although Bannon might. But he represented the old core Republican Party that represented the economic elites and that would appeal to the lower middle class, but really represented directly the interests of power. But the political movement associated with Trump, this neo-fascism, is rooted in the anger of the lower middle class, the white lower middle class, And Flake retired because he was going to he was clearly going to lose. He could not win an election in these circumstances. So he is making a statement, but it's in the context of what was for him very clearly a political defeat, going to be a political defeat. And I think we have to understand the power of this movement that's developing on the right. It's not something that you can address simply in moral terms, although that's an important factor. You actually have to understand this in class, economic terms, and in more sophisticated political terms than people are currently doing. It's often talked about as though this is an aberration, that this is just a bunch of racists, that Trump is sort of, it's an accident. None of this is very useful. What's useful is to understand just how powerful this political movement is on the right. They're calling it a national populist movement, or a nationalist populist movement in Breitbart. And this is very powerful, and it's a result of the economic stagnation in the United States, the effects on the lower middle class, its effect, the decline of U.S. hegemony in the world economy. All of these things are part and parcel of this. People like Bannon actually have a very sophisticated analysis of this in economic and political terms.
What would an effective resistance movement against all of this look like?
Well, I think it has to be much more unified movement. It has to be some kind of vast popular alliance, but it has to be... there has to be a lot of extra electoral mobilization. I even like to think of it as following David Harvey as a co-revolutionary coalition. But the various movements that are so powerful, the movements in the United States the social movements, organized movements, that they have numbers, an activism that's greater than the right. People have to actually mobilize. They have to take strong stands, and not simply protest, but doing things to block what is happening. I think the movement for the anti-imperialist movement is key. The movement for Black Lives Matter, the system change, not climate change movement, the women's movement, feminist movement. These movements, they have to come together in a radical coalition, and you can't really depend on the liberals. You can't depend on liberal elites who are already kind of bending in relation to this growth of this right-wing force. What we have to do is create a radicalism that demands more equality for people, that demands the human rights, that insists on fundamental changes in our economy and our state.
The title of your book is Trump in the White House, Tragedy and Farce. Extremely good book. I urge everybody to get Trump in the White House. And Heidi and I thank you for being on the radio show.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, John.
Yeah, every success, John. Take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.